Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your deadly nightshade of music news and cultural disputation. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. And you're hearing the contralto of Lana Del Rey. That's West Coast from her new record, Ultraviolence. John Pareles is here to talk about Lana Del Rey. Hi, John.
Hey, Ben.
You flew out to the epicenter of Del Reyitude recently.
True.
And you met Lana Del Rey.
I did, at her home. You know, I've met a bunch of pop stars over the years. There were no handlers. There were no publicist, you know, nervously fluttering in the wings, like she opened the door and we walked and we did the interview.
Well, now let's just talk about that for a second. Listeners not may know the extent to which she is a star, you know, because 2-3 years ago, when the first flurry of news and reactions to her was happening, she seemed for a moment like a flash in the pan.
She almost got a backlash before there was a front lash.
Right. So a lot of people might not know at this point that she is actually a successful recording artist. Can you kind of quantify that?
Well, she sold millions of copies worldwide of Born to Die, her first album.
Okay.
And the Paradise EP that was tacked onto it. Her first big video clip, Video Games, has something like 100 million views on just her sites alone, mm-hmm. which is astonishing to me. Somebody's clicking that button a lot. If you go to one of her shows, as I did and as I found when I looked at other shows online, there is just this devotional quality to her audience. They are standing there, front to back of the room, singing along, staring at her as if she's some kind of vision, some kind of saint. You know, you go to most arena concerts, big theater concerts, and the back of the room is where everybody's schmoozing and talking, especially
right.
during ballads.
Right.
First of all, a Lana Del Rey concert is all slow songs. There's
yeah.
no slow, fast, slow, fast.
Yeah.
It's like one dirge after another, and everybody is riveted, and everybody is singing along. It's a really different concert experience.
Like this record, Ultraviolence, is very, very slow.
Yeah, not a lot of high-speed stuff. I mean, she calls it narco swing. She credited it to the producer, Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys, but he didn't think it was his phrase. So somewhere in the studio, the word narco swing arose.
It sounds like some kind of, you know, South American thing. But the thing about everybody in the audience singing along and entering this ritual with her and kind of getting into the mood of the songs and kind of like getting in her head a little bit reminds me a little bit of the old Cat Power shows where Sean Marshall would sing these songs and at least project the persona of somebody who was having trouble. And the audience would be completely in there with her as if they were there to console her or to share this experience with her.
And also to empathize with it. I mean, people do have trouble. We're not all rich,
sure.
perfectly toned superstars, you know, in charge of the world. We're not world beaters like the big high definition pop stars like Rihanna.
Yeah.
She speaks for a lot of people.
Yeah.
They see their own weakness in her. They're consoling themselves as well as her.
So she's a downcast superstar.
And
that's part of her magnetism, is the magnetism of being downcast.
But, and she credits Cat Power too. She when she was playing New York clubs, she said, you know, she would think about how Cat Power could turn away from the audience and be floating into her own songs and the audience would go with her.
Would follow her.
That gave Lana Del Rey, then called Lizzie Grant, the idea that you didn't have to be a big polished star.
It kind of subverts the whole idea of performance in a way.
Well, Miles Davis used to turn his back.
Sure. Probably another one of Lana Del Rey's heroes. Why not? She's so into jazz on this record. She talks about jazz all over the place.
She does like jazz.
All right, let's talk about that later. I'm dying to talk about that. But first, going back to 2012 and the first songs that everybody heard and the videos that people saw and then the appearance of her record Born to Die, can you sort of sum up the reaction to her at first? And, you know, fast forward to now, 2 years later, is the discourse around her being changed?
Well, it's definitely changed. I mean, the reaction to her in 2012, I think, was pretty unfair. I mean, she was on a major label, bad thing in hipster land. She was singing about weakness, a bad thing, I guess, if you're a woman. She was different. Mm-hmm. She was slow. She was in her, you know, elevator pitch. She was the gangsta Nancy Sinatra. Mm-hmm. She was putting together things that weren't supposed to go together. She was putting together these sort of seedy, decadent, rough hip-hop scenarios with being a wilting flower. People jumped on her. I think there was almost a bullying aspect to it. You know, here's this person who presents weakness as herself, and let's jump on her. I really saw it in a lot of the, you know, she's not authentic, she's not real. I mean, she'd been doing it for years. I mean, she was Lizzie Grant trying to play coffee houses in Williamsburg in the mm-hmm. Lower East Side mm-hmm. for 6 or 7 years in New York City before she decided it didn't work.
Let's go into that a little bit more. It couldn't have been just that people were irritated by the projection of like a beautiful loser persona, because we're so used to that.
Well, what do you think
it
was?
We play that game really well. I don't know. I mean, wasn't it something else? Wasn't it some perception of, you know, hollowness, or she's not what she seems, or
yeah, no,
or
there, some, there was this
something
idea
is
that
not is
was,
not it was, connected. Something
it,
is
it
not
was
in
the
sync.
Major label thing. People decided that she was a corporate put up job.
Right.
If you go back, as I did, to the album she recorded as Lizzie Grant, it's just as strange and sad and decadent and troubled as Born to Die. Mm-hmm. The sound is a little different because it had a different producer, David Kahn. It's more upbeat. But what she was saying, the personality of Lizzie Grant in whatever, 2009, 2010, was already the same as Lana Del Rey.
Yeah.
But, you know, for some reason, people jumped on the changing her name, major label contract. People decided that she couldn't invent herself. She had to be a put-up job.
Right.
And I think that was basically wrong.
Let's bring up Kurt Cobain for a minute. I don't know if we want to go into the whole back and forth about Lana Del Rey and Francis Cobain, based on things that Lana Del Rey has said in interviews recently about artists who die young. But she's been talking about wanting to die. I mean, the first record was called Born to Die.
It's not far from the surface. She's a morbid girl.
The subject comes up in interviews. It came up with you. She said, "I'm scared to die, but I want to die." Right?
Yeah, and there was more that didn't fit on the page. I mean, she thinks a lot about death. She thinks about death as a relief and something she's afraid of.
Right. To the interviewer in The Guardian, right. She said, "I wish I was dead already."
I mean, she says things like this.
Right. So, and it comes out in the lyrics, too. And, you know, you think of the Nirvana song, "I Hate Myself and Want to Die." So, like, the text is there.
Well, also in her video, she shows herself being killed a lot, too. She's jumping off a bridge. She's getting strangled.
Right.
She's bloody.
Right.
She thinks a lot about death,
so,
as some people do.
But in the past, this wasn't accepted somehow as being real enough.
It was criticized as glamorizing images of death, which means we got to take down all the True Blood billboards around town
right.
that I see all the time.
Right.
I mean, but it's on her mind.
Sure.
I think she was being personal when people have decided that her obsessions are being prescriptive for everybody. I don't think she's saying go out and kill yourself.
Right.
I think she's saying these thoughts go through my mind. On the other hand, she works really hard at her career. So she does seem to have some future in mind.
Let's move on and hear a little bit of the song Brooklyn Baby from Lana Del Rey's new record, Ultraviolence.
Well, my boyfriend's in a band. He plays guitar while I sing Lou Reed. I've got feathers in my hair. I get down to be poetry.
Okay, John Pareles, Brooklyn Baby, a high point on Ultraviolence?
It makes me laugh every time I hear it.
What about it?
The hydroponic weed.
Yeah.
Who's cooler than who?
Yeah.
It makes fun of the hipsters who are making fun of her, to me.
Aha, uh-huh. Okay.
But it's also kind of, there's a sweetness to it, too. It's like,
so you think there's a tiny bit of revenge in there?
Yeah. I think so. Uh-huh. I mean, there's Revenge elsewhere on the album, too. Money, Power, Glory is basically like, yeah, okay, you think I want that? That's what I want. She was kind of nervous talking about that Money, Power, Glory because she thinks people are going to take it without irony. I mean, she's usually unironic. She puts in some irony. She figures people are going to take that seriously. Mm-hmm. She arouses very complicated reactions.
Because she's difficult to understand, maybe.
Well, because she's blurry. And the blur makes us humans want to figure out what's in the blur and give it harder contours.
It's hard to get what her level of intent is. Also, it's interesting how much you found out by talking to people that she's worked with, you know, sort of like record-making professionals.
Yeah.
How much you found out that, you know, her songwriting talent is real. It's co-signed by lots of people who work with her.
She gets guys to write chords and basically chords for her. They told me sometimes she'll come in with a complete lyric. Sometimes she'll come in with a melody. Sometimes they'll work together and she'll kind of improvise.
Yeah.
There's a song on the album, Pretty When You Cry, which she was basically working out with her guitarist and recording as they worked it out. And she was freestyling, she says. And that's the take that came out. That's what's on the record.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really wobbly and shaky and vulnerable and... Some people suggested that she, like, pretty it up and make it a better technical mm-hmm. performance, and she refused.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's after this truthfulness, in a way, in the middle of all this artifice, in the middle of all this invocation of icons, in the middle of all this Hollywoodness. She really wants some of that emotional truth.
In her interviews, which I still can't tell are highly artful or highly artless, she doesn't really talk about the mechanics of songwriting. She doesn't talk about...
She did, and nobody prints it. They're much more interested in the personality stuff.
Oh, okay.
Because she talked about it to me. I mean, it's in my story. On this album, the verses are pretty straightforward, single vocals, and then the choruses all get all murky, and voices come in from nowhere, and instruments come in from nowhere. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the exact quote, but it's the move from normality to the chaos mm-hmm. that echoes her life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... deliberate. That's thought through.
This is really interesting. So what you're saying is you feel that in the way that she's been reflected by people in a position to interview her, write about her, whatever, they can't get away from the fact that she's, you know, glamorous and seemingly blank, because that is completely fascinating for some reason. And it's great.
And the fact that she's a working musician.
Yeah, right. It completely eclipses anything about her being a working musician and craft and influences and stuff. Although influences.
Plenty.
Yes, but I mean, she says it. She talks about them in kind of blank ways, no? Doesn't she say things like, well, I like the greats in every genre.
Well, she has Whitman Nabokov tattooed on her arm.
What's that about?
Well,
we know that she's interested in Lolita as a concept, right?
Yeah. Actually, she told me that when she's stuck, she goes back and reads the first pages of Lolita for the wordsmithery of it, for the poetry of it, for the sheer language of it. That's what she gets from Whitman too. And you know, you can quote Body Electric. That's the Whitman phrase. But I think she does go deeper than that. She doesn't explain herself well.
Mm-hmm.
When I was at her house, you know, Jeff Buckley was on the turntable.
Yeah.
She does listen to this stuff. She's not making it up.
Yeah.
The other thing is the people around you sort of talk about Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
She's done that. I mean, there is a Tumblr page out there on the interwebs that has something like 19 albums worth of recordings of unreleased stuff that, you know, people have leaked on her. She's recorded a lot. She's written a lot of songs. She's not, you know, somebody who stumbled into it. She's been doing it with ambition and determination since she was a teenager.
There's a Nina Simone song on this record.
The Other Woman.
In going through interviews that she's done recently, somebody asked her about Nina Simone, and she said something like, I am inspired by early jazz culture, which blew my mind. But and then I thought, oh, you know, that's confusing. Does she think Nina Simone is early jazz, etc.? Can I imagine her listening to, you know, Bessie Smith records? And I thought, wait a minute, this record kind of is a Bessie Smith record. The degree to which she is getting into these kind of bad relationships with bad guys who are going to treat her badly, and like singing about those relationships with enthusiasm.
Or with obsession, maybe. I don't know if it's
obsession.
Enthusiasm. I mean, it's not so much boastful as it's I can't get away from it.
He loves his drugs. He loves his baby, too. That sounds like something straight out of Bessie Smith.
I mean, people are attracted to people who are bad, who are wrong for them, who are troubled, who are a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are. You know, the 7,000 people in the Shrine Expo Hall seem to be. Well, it's not boastful. Bessie Smith was I'm tough enough to handle it. Lana Del Rey is, I'm not so sure I'm tough enough to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing she told me was she listens to a couple of songs, she said, every day or listened to them every day for a while. One is Hotel California, which you can kind of hear in Pretty When You Cry. And the other is Bruce Springsteen's I'm on Fire. And the key line of Bruce Springsteen's I'm on Fire is, I got a bad desire. And sort of bad desire is what a lot of her songs are about.
Yeah. Speaking of quotations, she's quoting quite a lot in these songs, no? Ultraviolence, the title of the album, you know, comes from Clockwork Orange.
So I asked her about that because, I said, you know, you saw the reaction the last time, you know, were you trying to be provocative? She said, I like the sound of the word. And I wanted a lot of blue tones in this album, and I thought ultraviolence, ultraviolet. So it's not necessarily Clockwork Orange.
That's indirect.
It's very poetic and out there.
Okay. She also
quotes the Crystals. He hit me and it felt like a kiss.
He hit me and it felt like a kiss.
Which is a Goffin King song, actually.
She quotes one line as I'm talking about my generation.
This is not unknowing. This is the stuff that's floating around in her head, I think.
You've got the music in you.
That's, was that Kiki D?
I was thinking New Radicals. Yeah, maybe Kiki D as well. Queen of New York City. Isn't that a line from the Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York song? Anyway, I feel like these words and phrases are kind of popping into her head and she's referring to them. How knowing are her references? How much meaning should we be giving all that?
Well,
I don't know.
The Hit Me and He Felt Like a Kiss is definitely knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so are some of the chord progressions. In West Coast, there's a high synthesizer at the end because it's a Dr. Dre homage because he's the West Coast.
Who told you that? I mean, not that you're incapable of figuring it out yourself.
I actually said, you know, the high synthesizer at the end is that Dr. Dre. She said, yeah, we were calling that the Dre synthesizer.
Uh-huh.
It's deliberate.
Yeah.
Also, I got to say, Dan Auerbach did an amazing job with this album because it doesn't sound like anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, if she was the corporate put-up job she's supposed to be, wouldn't they have gotten in some, like, Beatmeister?
Yeah.
And you know, punched up the hip-hop? You know, made it radio friendly. This stuff is not radio friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, West Coast does this great thing of slowing down and changing the meter in the chorus,
mm-hmm.
And probably is driving radio programmers nuts.
It's two different songs.
It's two different songs.
Yeah,
and
it's very cool.
It's not an accident. They know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
The story behind making this record was she thought she had finished the record. She made a whole album. She starts with concepts like Gangsta Nancy Sinatra, and the concept she wanted for this album was a West Coast fusion with underground jazz.
I don't hear the underground jazz that much either.
But if you listen to the first guitar line of Cruel World that opens the album, it's Sloop John B. It's the Beach Boys.
That great underground jazz group.
No, that's the West Coast fusion.
Oh, sure,
but no,
sure.
But she also wants Laurel Canyon folk. She wants all the West Coast stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I hear more West Coast fusion than jazz.
Sure.
But she took the album she had made to Auerbach and he said, I don't hear what you want in this album. And they basically remade the whole thing.
West Coast fusion maybe with a little bit of Bristol in the earlier mid-90s. I mean, isn't there also a kind of like slow...
But Bristol had a lot of bass.
Thing?
Bristol, I mean, the trip-hop had a lot of, like, really heavy sub-bass.
Mm.
I don't hear that in this. I hear, like, a band. And a lot of it's live in the studio, I was told.
Mm-hmm.
You know, live in the studio plus overdubs.
Right.
But them reacting to one another, which you also don't hear on the radio. It's very unquantized, this album, which I really like. There's a human being in there.
Let's hear one more example from the record, the track Pretty When You Cry.
I'm pretty when I cry.
right, so that's Pretty When You Cry from Lana Del Rey. John, what's the distinguishing thing about that song?
Well, that's the song that was the first take in the studio. That's the song you hear being written. I mean, they added a lot of stuff, but that's the song that you hear the guitar players playing the chords and she's freestyling.
Mm-hmm.
It's also one really messed up relationship that maybe people are identifying with. It's, to me, a really vulnerable, fragile, kind of brave song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, bullies think you're pretty when you cry, too.
Yeah.
And there's courage and vulnerability, and that's what I hear in that song.
And hedonism in it, too. You know? I mean, vulnerability can be very...
You can wallow.
You can get high on it. You can wallow in it, yes. It can take you to another place. It can... Just like any emotion, you can kind of, it can take you someplace if you do a lot of it.
It's an odd song to put out there. And she didn't pretty it up. She didn't remake the vocal as, you know, somebody stronger and better in tune.
Mm.
You know, it's just out there. I mean, it is like a Cat Power song very much to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I find it moving.
John, I think there is some unity to this record, not just in sound, but in theme. And not just the sort of general theme of, you know, sadness, but there's this idea of the other woman, the persona of the other woman.
Yeah, I mean, that's why the Nina Simone song is kind of the postscript to the album. She told me when in her songwriting, she said, I'm either documenting or I'm dreaming.
Yeah, that was an interesting quote. I try to do one of two things, right?
Right.
Interesting, very specific comment.
Yeah. Not like, you know, I sing what they give me.
Yeah.
I mean, she really is her own agent.
Yeah.
But in this album, there are a number of songs about being the other woman, about being one of a guy's many playthings. And the guy is not a good guy. The guy is druggy and maybe violent and oblivious and self-absorbed. And she's pulling away from him on this album.
Mm-hmm.
But in Sad Girl, she says, you know, you may not think it's so great to be the other woman, but that's who I am. I've tried it. I'm a sad girl. I'm a bad girl. I mean, she's in these murky relationships where the power is always shifting, where she's not sure she's doing the right thing. She's drawn to it anyway. It's blurry. And I think it draws people in more in a way than some of the high definition, I'm on top of the world, or I hate you. This amorphousness is what she's about. It's something that's hard to do because it's such a balancing act. Somebody, a hole to throw their energy in, they will.
It's the thrill of negative capability. It's understanding that negative capability is a turn on, you know, is a high.
I mean, when I saw her at the Shrine in L.A., she went down twice into the photo pit and basically collected offerings from people, you know, and people hugged her and people handed her things and probably I love you notes and artifacts. I have no idea. There was more than the 4-foot perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And the video camera followed her down so you could see all the hugs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was part of the ritual.
Yeah.
You know, I saw her with a totally devoted audience. I mean, were people cackling at Coachella saying, you know, what the heck is this?
No.
Or were they all, no, they're riveted.
No, because that, you know, that news cycle has already passed. Now,
right.
Now we're in the next cycle of there's something to this. Either you knew it from the start, or now it's like, well, apparently there's something to this.
The other thing that's interesting about her is, you know, she's really bypassed radio. There's no top 10 hit except the remix, which I asked her about, and she stayed silent. That was the Cedric Gervais remixed, what was it, Summertime Sadness.
Mm-hmm.
And that was her top 10 hit. So that fit the radio format.
Mm-hmm.
So, but she has millions of fans. And millions of actual sales.
I wonder if Miley Cyrus covering Summertime Sadness helped her in the sort of general, the most general audience kind of sense.
It might be later, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the timing was. I mean, because Miley's doing it on tour now. Hard to say.
I have to say that I went back today and I looked at a video of her performance on Saturday Night Live 2 years ago, which was, you know, widely mocked.
Yeah.
People were angered almost by the fact that she seemed awkward, she seemed ill-prepared. There were a couple of notes she didn't hit.
Oh, my God, a live singer not missing?
Right. The basic complaint was she's not ready for this.
Right.
How dare Saturday Night Live put somebody before us who clearly isn't ready, because it's an insult to us and our sense of taste. But I gotta say, I didn't think it was so. I mean, I don't remember what I thought 2 years ago, but I thought it was perfectly fine.
That's who she is. I mean, I think we didn't know who she was at the time, and we were being shown somebody with a made-up name that was being hyped by a record company.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the reaction was to. The kind of languor or lassitude or listlessness, depending on how pejorative you want to be, that she projects, we didn't know who she was then. Now we know who she is. So she was sort of ahead of us.
She's educating us in lassitude, in the higher lassitude.
I think so. What do we want her to do, a cheerleader routine? I mean, you know, that's what her songs are. They're slow, morbid ballads.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't think I want to see, you know, a dance routine with that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something in stillness, and you don't see that much stillness in pop. You know, she's doing it with her ballads. There's that whole James Blake school of synthesizer stuff. There's Kalela. I mean, I think slow is the new fast.
I'm going to think on that very, very slowly.
Or maybe not.
Thanks for coming, John.
Thanks, Ben.
And you're hearing Sad Girl from Lana Del Rey's Ultraviolence. That's our show. You can read John Pareles on Lana Del Rey at nytimes.com/music and listen to our Spotify playlist. Our producers are Jeremy Egner and Jocelyn Gonzalez. Thanks for listening. See you next week.